Hi, this is Fabrice Lapeltree for Creative Disturbance Project Pioneers and Pathbreaker channel. I'm a French art historian. My guest today is the British curator, writer and researcher Bronagh Ferran. We are today with the English writer Rich Ganley to speak about his relationships with the artist engineer Frank Molina in the late 50s and in the 60s.
So, Reg, it's Brona now, continuing the conversation with you about the influence and impact of Frank and his work on your life and your views on his the process for which he developed his work. What intrigues me is that you, at a very young age, became someone who wrote, I think in quite an exceptional way, other than what Frank Popper was doing at the time, about what we now call kinetic art. Would you like to tell me a little bit more about what inspired you to do this?
It occurred to me, and I think I was 22 years old, and having got to know Frank and his work extremely well, that the only really major article that had appeared was in what, after all, was a fairly obscure magazine, by general standards, the UNESCO Courier, written brilliantly by Frank Popper under the mentorship of Sandy Koffler. And I, as an first-year undergraduate at Cambridge, sought out ways and means whereby I could pursue the advocacy of what I already thought, as I, albeit just a young student, was someone who was doing really remarkable work. It wasn't particularly easy, and it started my writing when I did a dissertation for my English literature degree, which was called Towards Kinetic Art, and I suppose I started writing that in 60. Or thereabouts. And to my pleasure, it was very well received. That encouraged me to then publish a series of articles and reviews in Cambridge magazines and newspapers, such as Granter, the Cambridge Review, Varsity, Broadsheet, I have four or five of them, Image as well, so that makes up around six. And these things came out at regular intervals, and gradually received attention by a much wider audience. It was later that it was decided to put on a rather unusual exhibition, combining both kinetic art with concrete poetry. And this I did with Mike Weaver, who at that time had established himself as the leading expert or advocate of concrete poetry. And there seemed to be a link between the two in a general sort of way, but I'm bound to say it was cultural. If you look at the man who figured chiefly in the concrete poetry side of the exhibition, Ian Hamilton Finlay, it had nothing whatsoever to do with what Frank was doing in Paris. And somehow these two The best of the poetry and the art got married together in this exhibition. And it did receive a great deal of attention. Frank's work, I think there was a work by Frank in it, certainly, but also I think by Kalos. I myself put in two works of my own, which have long since disappeared. And from then on, subsequent exhibitions took place in both Paris and elsewhere. But that's how initially it happened in Cambridge. The Stephen Bann became an advocate of concrete poetry, but that was his chief interest.
So what you're describing, in a way, is a convergence of both people and ideas which were in the air, and to some extent migration of ideas from and works from all around the world, and in this case, primarily this trajectory between Paris and England, where you started introducing some of these ideas to the UK art context. Did you have a sense that this was something that was difficult to explain, or that there was a kind of a receptivity to some of what you were writing about?
Yes, I did. And what I was particularly aware of, and I still think to this day is actually something disgraceful, was that Cambridge was almost anti-visual art. For example, one of the greatest museums in the world, which is actually owned by the university syndics, the Fitzwilliam Museum, had no proper electric light. It used to close at 2:30 in the afternoons. And some of us felt this was disgraceful. Literary people at the time, numbering any number of well-established poets subsequently, like John Barrow, Clive James, Jim Phillip, just paid no attention to this at all. They were the dominant forces, let alone the dons. Jeremy Prynne was one, who just, however much they may bleat now and protest, simply had no interest in art whatsoever. If they did, they kept quiet about it. But the rest of us felt that art, the visual arts, deserves far more than just the sort of rather trim little faculty of architecture that they had shoved up outside in a terrace where people put models in the garden. I mean, the whole thing was quite ridiculous. It was a wonder they didn't put names in. It was just ludicrous. There were one or two exceptions. Sandy Wilson, Colin St. John Wilson, was one who showed interest, but on the whole they didn't. And so one really was attacking the establishment at Cambridge.
And so this link between the visual arts and the literary arts, which I'm personally very interested in, you were definitely pioneering the use of language through these various sources of criticism and publishing to articulate works and approaches that perhaps spanned different boundaries and different disciplines.
Well, it's very flattering of you to say so, and I'm touched. I have to say that in my defence, I was only a 22-year-old student, and some of the language betrays, I think, a kind of innocent clumsiness, which some may find fetching. I look at it and sort of go a bit pale. But nonetheless, we did tell the story of what was happening in Paris, of all places. And how extraordinary it seems to me in reflection that this was going on in Paris. There we were, sitting in the miserable, foul winters of the early 60s in Cambridge, writing about a movement which most people at Cambridge thought that we were absolutely clinically insane. And that was the sort of effect they had. They didn't like it. I mean, they wanted to produce plays and write sort of absurdly short, lazy poetry, which is what they did. And they got the credits, we got nothing. I'm not the slightest bit worried about that, because, look, we wouldn't be here talking now about something as remarkable as what it was that not just I, but all of us, I think, achieved, but most particularly people like Frank Molina and Schaffer and Weston and the others, Nino Kalos, largely generated, one has to say, by Frank Molina. He was the central driving, presiding force, and his legacy is vast. And as I've said elsewhere, the time has come to recognise this, and I have absolutely no doubt that within 10 or 15 years from now, this sort of interview won't be the slightest bit necessary. Everybody will know the story.
So are you aware that, for example, some of those magazines that you were involved in editing and writing for are you know, being sold for quite a lot of money now, and the price is going up? And also there was a Sotheby's or Christie's show of kinetic art earlier this year, where the prices again are pretty high. So there is this, I don't know, 40 years, 50 years later, there's now this kind of market awareness of what was perhaps for you then as a student, something you were espousing. How do you respond to that kind of adaptation, if you like, of the mood over time?
Well, I don't know. I'm no economist. I was totally unaware that they're worth anything. I'm bound to say I see that the magazine image which we produced to do with kinetic art sold at the time for 1 shilling, which is the equivalent now, I think, 10 pence. If it's worth a bit more now, well, I'm very happy that a few sort of idiots who've kept the thing go out and make an awful lot of money. And I would recommend thoroughly that they go and put it on the nearest horse or give it to the first poor man in the street that they meet.
So was there a sense that you were part of a network at the time, that there were other people and you were sort of exchanging ideas and, you know, cross-referencing?
No, none whatsoever. We never met socially. We had no groups. I would imagine, what does it take to form a network? I suppose with most Englishmen, a lot of beer. I don't think I drank ever more than about half a pint a month. I wasn't interested in social networks. I'm not the slightest bit interested in literary coteries. I find the whole idea of young British novelists, prizes, and all the frummery. Oh, my God, the titles. Can you see any number of these idiots who are appearing in the front of the newspapers now thinking they're sort of glamorous cowboys and write short, impenetrable novels about the things they don't know anything about, particularly the Holocaust? I just wish a lot of them would get stuffed. But no, so you can imagine I was an anarchist and a rebel, and we all were. And there was no sense of a network. And by the way, I would like to add too that, of course, this was very much before anything like the internet occurred. It doesn't need me to tell people something that's so obvious, or perhaps it does. Turn on your Apple and look at your wallpaper and those swirling colours. You know who really pioneered that? Frank Molina. But where in the name of Apple is Frank Molina? Adam and Eve, Apple and Frank Molina. You heard it here first.